Mad, Mark After Dark, the man that hates everything except the real thing. Coming to you once again, live on the air. Tonight on the program, legendary guitarist of Thin Lizzy, Eric Bell. How did you handle the pressure of the record company demanding another hit after the success of Whiskey in the Jar?
Yeah, this is when the fun really started. Up to that point in time, I was so happy with Thin Lizzy. I was one of the happiest guys on the planet as far as music was concerned and so on and so on. It was fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
And then Whiskey in the Jar became a hit. Everything started changing. Suddenly, our managers started taking us serious. They'd actually come and watch us at gigs, which they didn't really do before. I was told my guitar solos were too long. I'm boring the audience with them, which I just freaked and said, you stick to your fucking phone in the office and let me play the guitar, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I started getting on the defensive and drinking a lot more and so on. And Philip was a very, very dedicated musician at mm-hmm. this point in time. He absolutely loved music, loved playing music and so on. Much more than wanting to be a star. Well, he wanted to be a star, but on par was music as well. He wanted to be a brilliant bass player and so on. And we used to jam quite a lot on stage, you know, make mm-hmm. things up. That was part of Thin Lizzy.
Yeah.
So at this point in time, guys from the record company would appear, our management would appear, and they would watch us and say, there's too much jamming on stage and you haven't got a show and so on, which was probably true. But they sort of wanted to make us into a pop band. And so they said, right, what are you going to record for your second single? It has to be another Irish song.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, yeah. They said, you're in the door now. You've got a hit. Now, everybody that has a hit record always follows it up with part two, something very similar. So we all went, no fucking way. We're not that type of band. So we recorded this ridiculous song called Randolph's Tango.
Yeah, I know. I know the song.
I mean, Jesus, to this day, I don't know why, but we did. And it was the most different song in the universe from Whiskey in the Jar. And Philip would go, no, man, we're serious musicians. We're not going to follow up Whiskey in the Jar with Whiskey in the Jar Part 2. We've got our own song. And it came out, and it didn't do a thing. It was complete flop. And Phil was freaked. Phil thought it was going to be a hit. Which I think we all did. Well, me and Bran and Philip thought it was going to be a hit, and it didn't do a thing. It was like just played on the air, completely disappeared after a few weeks. And our manager said, right, we fucking told you. We fucking told you. You should have recorded another fucking Irish song. So Phil then started changing a bit. Philip had a taste of Top of the Pops and a little taste of being famous for a few months, and he wanted it again, and he wanted it badly.
Mm-hmm. That's, yeah.
So Bran Downey, in a way, didn't really care one way or the other, and I went the other direction. I said, no, man, I don't want another fucking hit, because they'll tell us what to wear and what to say and how to play and how to play this and bow here and do that. And I said, it's going to completely ruin the band, you know. We've got our own thing. Why don't we stick to it? So the third song we had was The Rocker, which we really thought was going to be a hit.
Very strong song. I love that song.
They took out most of my guitar solo, which I couldn't believe. And they took out one of Philip's verses, I think, and he was really fucking so annoyed about that. He said, it's a fucking story, man, and the song doesn't make fucking sense if you take out one of the verses. So anyway, they released that, and it wasn't a hit. It was a sort of a hit underground, but it wasn't a hit sort of commercially. So around that point in time, we started getting very rocky. Things started becoming very insecure because Philip wanted another hit. Decca, I think, was going to drop us if we didn't have another hit. Our management kept saying, you fucking blew it. We told you to do a second Irish song and you didn't listen to us. So it was all getting very shaky.
Okay. Well, in the fall of 73, Thin Lizzy released the third album, Vagabonds of the Western World. The second track I always found kind of odd. The Hero and the Madman featured radio personality David Kidd Jensen again. How did this come to be, and what is this song about? I asked Brian what this song was about, and he was like going, I have no clue, so I'm asking you.
Well, I'll tell you a few things about this, which is I haven't told many people this. Around that point in time, I started getting very fucked up, you know?
Yes, I do know. You were drinking a lot.
I mean, fucked up with a capital F. You know, like to the point where some of the bands that we were on with, I was convinced that they had landed by UFO.
Oh, God. Well, that I didn't know.
Yeah, this is true. I mean, I was smoking a lot of very, very strong dope. A lot, and drinking a lot as well. And some things in my personal life was going a bit weird. You know, my girlfriend leaving, and she had a baby, and she fucked off in our bloke, and so on and so on. And I was living in this horrible place in London. I mean, everybody thought Thin and Lizzy was fucking millionaires, you know, living the life of the pop star. I was living in an attic in this horrible house owned by these people from Poland who didn't like me and so on. Anyway, I just started becoming very, very strange. And I went to the doctor and I got Librium and Valium. I started taking that as well as the dope and the drink. So I started sort of slowly leaving the planet. And it came to a head one day when we were in recording
The Hero and the Madman?
Yeah. When we were recording the first album. I'm off on a tangent here now thinking about this. And one of the tracks, Hero and the Madman. So we were getting on pretty well with the album. And I went out to put on the guitar solo on Hero and the Madman. And I remember to this day, I was out in a studio of my own, and I was just out of it completely. And I looked at the sort of the control room, and Philip and Bram was looking at me, and the engineers and the roadies and so on. So about 7 or 8 people. And I had the earphones on. And the track came on, Oh, Are You the Hero? Oh, Are You the Madman? And I started going off on this tangent, thinking it was about me. If you can relate to this.
No, God.
Yeah, so I'm hearing this through the headphones. I'm standing there with my guitar in this empty studio, and I'm, Oh, Are You the Hero? Bam, bam, bam. Oh, Are You the Madman? And I go, fuck me, this is about me, you know? And, oh, dear, you know? I mean, that's all I can remember about that song.
Wow. That's
incredible. Yeah, and that's when I started thinking about maybe I should be getting out of here.
With the single The Rocker, as we talked about, failing to hit the charts, and the Vagabonds album selling poorly, on New Year's Eve 1973, you decided to leave Thin Lizzy. Do you have any regrets about leaving the band? And what was your impression of Lizzy after you left?
Well, I'll tell you how it came about, if we've got time.
We've got plenty.
Well, that particular time was around, I think it was around Christmas.
Mm-hmm. It's the Christmas
and
tour.
We were starting to do a tour in Ireland, and I hadn't been home to my house where my family was for quite a while. So when we got to Belfast that day, I asked the road managers, I won't be staying in a hotel with Philip and Bran. I'll be staying in my family's house. Can you give me a lift over? And the gig in Queen's University was on that night. So the roadies dropped me off at my family's house in Belfast. It was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And when I rapped the door, there was no answer. My family wasn't there. They were out working, whatever it was. So anyway, this neighbor came out, this old woman called Mrs. Corbett, who was our neighbor. And she says, "Oh, Eric, I haven't seen you for a long time, blah, blah, blah. I think we're all right. Do you want to come in?" So I sort of looked at her and said, "Yeah." So I went into her house. So she made me a cup of tea and asked me how things were going. And I felt very distant, you know, like being on tour for such a long time and then being in someone's house with this old lady. I found it pretty strange, you know. Anyway, she brought out the proverbial cheap wine that they have in Belfast, and I had a few drinks with her. And then my family came home, and I went in to see them, and I had one or two drinks with them. Now, this is in the afternoon, and then by the time I got up to Queen's University, Philip and Brown wasn't there yet. So the guy brought me into this huge changing room, and there was this huge big table with a big white cloth over it. So the guy left me in this room on my own, and I took the white cloth off, and there was every drink that has ever been invented by man was on that table. You know, spirits, wine, beer, whatever you care to mention.
So you had a New Year's Eve, because it was New Year's Eve, so you had a New Year's Eve party pre-New Year's Eve.
Sure.
Essentially.
So anyway, it was wrong, you know, to put me in that fucking room. So about an hour later, I didn't know who I was, where I was, what I was supposed to do. Philip and Brian came then, and, you know, I just looked at them and started giggling, you know. And I said, "Oh, for fuck's sake, you better get this guy some coffee." So anyway, then I met some old friends from Belfast out in the bar later on, and they bought me a few drinks. So I was totally
blasted,
completely fucking, I shouldn't have been there, you know. So at the time we went on to do the show, I was like totally blitzed, completely. I didn't know what a guitar was. We went on, and the place was packed. You know, it was like about 1,500 people there, and that's all it held. And some of my family's at the front, the very front row, and some Philip's girlfriend and her family's there. Oh, man. And after about the fourth song, I just started hallucinating on stage. I couldn't believe it. I seen this sort of, like a group of people on my side of the stage, but they weren't there, and then they were. And I said, fucking what? And I couldn't control the feedback of the guitar. You know, a lot of the time I used to play on feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And this night, it was just a noise. I couldn't control it.
Wow.
And something, there was just a voice inside my head just said, listen, Eric, you got to get out of here. You know, you got to fucking leave this situation or you're going to end up dead. And I just, you know, started thinking about it, and something said, you know, just take your guitar off, throw it up in the air, take the amplifiers off, and fucking get out. And I did that. I just listened to this voice that we all have, you know.
Oh,
threw
yeah.
the guitar up in the air. No, fuck off. But this particular night, I listened to it. I just sensed I had to get out. You know, I would either be an alcoholic or a junkie or a mental institution or dead. That's what was going on in my head. And that's what I did.
What was your impression of Thin Lizzy after you left? What did you think of, you know, Gorm Robertson and all the guitar players that followed and the album?
I couldn't think of them at all.
So you didn't have, you have no impression of...
It didn't interest me in the slightest. Thin Lizzy to me was the first album.
Hmm.
You know, that was Thin Lizzy to me. That was the real Thin Lizzy. Our first album was Thin Lizzy. And that was it. So I, you know, oh yeah, they've kept the same name, but they're not Thin Lizzy, you know.
Okay. So
I mean, I wasn't, you know, like, don't get me wrong, I wasn't bitter about it. I wished them all the success in the world, because especially Philip and Brian, they deserved it.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't take any interest whatsoever, you know.
Okay, well, so you never heard the albums after the Jailbreak album or Johnny the Fox or any of those albums? You just...
No. Well, I mean, you know, like in people's houses, some of my musician friends would probably have Johnny the Fox, and they'd say, oh, Eric, have you heard Thin Lizzy's new album? I said, no. And they put on a track, and they go, yeah, great. And that was it. But, you know, like, it didn't interest me at all.
You formed the Eric Bell Band after leaving Thin Lizzy. What was it like playing in this band as compared to Lizzy at this point in your career?
It was very, very strange, because I just didn't know what I wanted at all. In fact, the Thin Lizzy management, after I left Thin Lizzy, they said, what are you going to do? I said, well, I'm going to leave London for a start, because I was living in London. And I'm going to move, well, I'm from Belfast, but I lived in Dublin for a long time. So I said, the first thing I'm going to do is move back to Dublin. I've had enough of London.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what are you going to do then? Well, I'm going to form my own band. Do you want us to manage you? No. you know, it was crazy. I mean, the mistakes I made when I think about it now,
mm-hmm.
I should have said yes, but I didn't. And in a way as well, I just wanted a break from music, because it's a bit strange sometimes. It's a bit like I was sort of a rock casualty, but I got out alive.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so did I.
Well, I mean, a lot of them don't, you know.
I know. A lot of good ones don't. Phil didn't,
and I was lying on top of my double bed, smoking a joint with Paul Kossoff.
Wow.
4 days before he died.
That's amazing.
America with Noel Redding.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jeez. You know, all these type of things. So, you know, I mean, I've seen a lot of that, and I'm glad that I got out when I did. But I just, when I went back to Dublin, I sort of bought a push bike and tried to get myself a bit healthy again. Didn't really play much. I just wanted to break away from it all.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started forming these little bands, which they weren't great, you know, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what type of music to play. Some of the musicians didn't know what I was trying to do. So it was really, really difficult. And then I did form an Eric Bell band, and they sounded okay. It wasn't bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I got 6 gigs in London for that band.
Yeah, I know.
Dublin band. And I got these 6 gigs in London, like the Marquee Club and Dingwalls, you know, pretty good clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And I told the band, I said, "You won't believe it. I've got you 6 gigs in London, and we're going in a month." And they all thought I was joking. Anyway, we came to London and we played the 6 gigs. And there was a few guys down from the music press, and they give, you know, they sort of reviewed the group. They reviewed the group, and they basically said, "Saw Eric Bell band last night. The rest of the musicians couldn't keep up with Eric Bell's imagination," or something.
Yeah.
Something like that. Anyway, the rest of the band read this, and they fucking thought I'd written it, you know?
Wow.
And they said, what the fuck's all this about? I said, "Listen, mate, I didn't write it. You know, it's nothing to do with me." And they threw me out of my own fucking band.
I know. I mean, what was that like? To be fired from your own band?
Yeah, they fucking fired me from the Eric Bell band, and they got another guitar player because they didn't get a good write up, and I did.
Oh, jeez.
And I said, you know, I kept saying, "It's not my fucking fault. You know, you should practice more." You know. Anyway, you know, I formed a few other Eric Bell bands, and it was no big deal, really. It was just sort of something to do. But then I got a phone call from Noel Redding.
Yeah, you joined the Noel Redding band.
Yeah.
Were you excited, having been a big Hendrix fan, to be asked to join? And were you anticipating that this outfit would recreate the glory days of the Experience?
Well, that was exactly what was in my head. I thought, the guy wants to form a trio, a 3-piece band, and he's got in touch with me. Great. So I went down to meet him, and I was very starstruck when I met him, because he just looked like Noel Redding, you know, the pink granny glasses and the velvet fucking bell bottoms and the hair, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And a very funny guy, like humorously very funny guy. And then when I got there, I met the fucking keyboard player and the drummer. And I thought, oh, fuck no, it's a 4-piece.
Yeah, you wanted it to be you and the bass.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I have the 2 albums. I thought they were real good.
And they played me the songs.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave me a cassette of these songs to put guitar on. And I didn't know what to do. I thought, fuck, I didn't like the music at all. It was bizarre. You know, I just couldn't relate to it. The style of writing, and lots of keyboards in it. And I didn't know where to put the guitar, and very structured sort of songs. And it didn't feel natural to my style of playing.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of felt like a fish out of water with that band. And I couldn't get on with them. And Noel was still going through his extremely strong dope and drinking a lot of spirits.
Mm-hmm.
And becoming very nasty.
Yeah.
But he ended up one of my best friends. Me and Noel got really close after a long time.
Well, Also, Steve Marriott got involved in the mix, or maybe the unmixing, more accurately, of some songs.
Who was this?
Steve Marriott. For you, meeting Steve Marriott seemed to be a very positive one. Would you have been Would you have been interested in collaborating with him?
Steve, God love him. We did a few songs in Ireland, I think.
Mm-hmm.
With this guy called Muff Winwood, who's Stevie Winwood's brother, and he was producing it. I don't know what happened, but we weren't very happy with it. So Noel said, "Hey, mate, let's get down to Steve Marriott's place. He's got a studio." So we went down to Steve Marriott's house, which was a beautiful thatched little English villagey type house, absolutely beautiful. That's the first time I met Steve Marriott, and he was a really nice guy, and, you know, we got on very well. So we stayed in his house for a few hours, and then we went back to our hotel and left the tapes of the three songs that we were going to try and do something with at Steve's place. So the next morning, Noel got up and he fucking banged my hotel room door. "Eric?" I said, "What?" I sort of get up out of bed. He says, "You won't fucking believe it, silly cunt." I said, "What?" He says, "Fucking Marriott. Marriott gets up during the fucking night to play about with the songs, and he fucking wiped the three of them off the tip."
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, he's so out of it, you know, that Steve was a bit of a lad, you know. And he said, "Fuck me, can you believe it?" And Noel went on and on and on and on about it, like for weeks after it. That was our only time with Steve Marriott.
After leaving Noel Redding, you joined a band called Main Squeeze. How did you make the adjustment from playing in a three- or four-piece band to playing in an eight-piece band?
Main Squeeze were brilliant, absolutely fabulous. They were totally steeped in blues. John Mayall,
mm-hmm.
Ex-members of John Mayall Band. There was Dick Hextall Smith and saxophones.
Yeah, I love
Keith
that.
Keith Hart. Yeah.
I love that.
Keith
stuff.
Hartley on drums.
What a great band.
Fabulous blues drummer. Keith Tillman on bass, Victor Brox on vocals and trumpet. You know, the pedigree was fabulous. It was just that they were so good. And they somehow got my name and they asked me to come along for, you know, to try me out.
Mm-hmm.
And the first note, I just knew, you know, it was just, oh, it was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could play blues with that band all night. You know, it was just, it was marvelous.
That's great. But what was it like playing alongside Bo Diddley?
Oh, Bo was a gentleman. He was a beautiful person. And he had seen it all. He had done it all. And he wasn't any way big-headed or conceited or anything. He was a beautiful man. And it's just such a young spirit. You know, the guy was, I don't know what age he was when I worked with him. He was probably about 60, 64, 65. But he was like a big kid, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And everything, he hadn't lost that sense of wonder. You know, he just seemed to love life.
Oh, that's cool.
Great player, great songs. And laughed a lot and, you know, looked after himself. Still liked the women, you know. danced amazing on the stage, you know, threw these great shapes on stage. And he just lived it, you know.
Okay, well.
And he's a great guy.
Yeah. Well, in 1983, you and some of the past guitarists of Thin Lizzy, I know we're going back to there, of Thin Lizzy regrouped for the live album Life. What was it like being on stage with Phil and Brian again at that point?
It was a strange day because it was looked like about 10 guitar players on the stage, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just there's like this, you know, the guitar necks are like the Spanish Armada, you know, all these masts and these gigantic amplifiers, like just this wall of marshals. I don't know, there must be 30 marshals, you know, just stacks. So anyway, I was standing on the stage and Philip walked in. I hadn't seen him for quite a while. And I had this very old black and white photograph of me and Philip together with these two girls when Everything Lizzy first started. So I said, "Hey, Phil, what do you see this?" And he came over and he looked at it and he says, "Listen, man, don't fucking show that to anybody, right?" He said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Don't fucking show that to anybody, right?" I said, "Okay, man, don't fucking worry about it. I just want you to see it. You know, it's fucking memories, old time's sake."
He's quite a character.
I think his hair was out of place or something. Anyway, we started all playing together. It was so loud, I couldn't hear it, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
It went beyond volume.
Yeah.
It was so loud I couldn't hear it. And I mean, this was at the rehearsal, and we were doing the rocker. And Phil said, comes over to me and he says, "Roy, Eric, you know that part in the rocker where you go, or whatever, something like that." He says, "Whenever you hit that, all the other guitar players is going to play that with you, right?"
Are they going to do it all in harmony?
Harmony or unison or whatever. And I said, "Okay." So we got to that part where all the guitar players joined in, and it was absolutely deafening. It was, I mean, you just wouldn't believe how loud it was. I mean, there was like 8-7 guitar players. So I stopped playing and no one noticed, you know. That's how loud it was.
Well, you had Sykes and Gorham and Robertson and, oh my God.
And Gary.
Gary, sure. Oh my God. Yeah. All amazing players, all of you guys.
Yeah, well...
Well, in 1998, Metallica did a cover of Whiskey in the Jar on their Garage Days Inc. album. What was your impression of their version?
This is very strange because at that time I was doing a lot of tours in Sweden,
mm-hmm.
with the Eric Bell Band. We seemed to tour Sweden every 2 months. We just nearly lived in Sweden, and at the end of one of the shows, you know, there was guys coming in, you know, to see me and ask for signatures and things. And one of them said, "Well," and then every gig I played, somebody would come into the change room and say, "Eric, what do you think of Metallica's Whiskey in the Jar?"
Sorry.
And I said, I said, "Who? I'd never heard of Metallica." I know it's hard to believe, but I'm not into that type of music, you know. So I'd never heard the name Metallica. Like, I must live a fucking very sheltered life.
But I don't know.
Seriously, I didn't know who Metallica was. I'd never heard of them. And I said, "I haven't heard it." So then the next night I'd play somewhere else in Sweden. And people would come into the changing room and ask me the same question. "Eric, what do you think of Metallica's Whiskey in the Jar?" I said, "I don't know, I haven't heard it." So what happened was, about a week later, we went to the airport to get a plane back to London, and it was delayed for about an hour and 40 minutes or something. So I started walking about the airport to kill time, and I went into one of the music shops, and I looked through M for Metallica, and I couldn't believe it. It had about 15 albums, and I said, "Fuck me." I mean, it's just how big this band is. And I looked up Garage Inc. and I seen it. And I said, right. And then I opened up the cover and I looked and it said, Whiskey in the Jar, arrangement Metallica. So I said, okay, when I get back to London, I'll go to the library. I won't buy it. I'll go to the library and order it, get it for 35 pence, and bring it home and listen to it. So I went and I got it out of the library. They had it, and I brought it home. And I put it on, and it was... And I said, right. So I phoned up in Lizzie's office, and I said, can I speak to Chris Morrison, please? And Chris came on the phone. He says, hello, Eric, what can I do for you? I said, well, I just got this album by Metallica, and they've put down arrangement. He says, yes, we know all about it. Our lawyers is on to it at the moment. So Metallica was under the impression that Thin Lizzy's version of Whiskey in the Jar was the original. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Way back in time. But the original version of Whiskey in the Jar is like this drunken Irish guy going, as I was going over the fucking Kerry Mountains. Yeah? Sort of strumming a banjo with it. And all the guitar work was what I thought up.
Yeah.
So, but they were under the impression that that guitar work was always there. So anyway, to cut a long story short, they got in touch with me quite a while later, and they asked me to do a gig with them in Dublin. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Which was very strange, to say the fucking least. They had their own private plane.
Well, they're Metallica. They're huge.
Yeah. And I sat in the private plane with them, and I didn't know any of them. And they were sort of halfway through a world tour, so they were all sort of totally spaced out, you know. But the funny thing was, in this private plane, the seat I was on was the only one facing this way, and the rest of them were facing the other way. So they put me in this seat, facing all of them, sitting looking at me. Which is very, very strange, you know. And then I think the bass player must have took pity on me. But he came up and he started talking to me, and he's a really nice guy, you know. And we went to this place in Dublin called the Point Theatre, which holds about 9,000-10,000 people. And this is the very funny thing about it, is that they tune the guitars down a whole tone.
Yeah, they... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, can you believe that? I mean, it's not half a tone, it's a whole tone.
Tone, I know, they do that.
Wow. So they said to me, hey, you know something, we tuned down a whole tone, and I said, no, I don't do that. And they said, well, what the fuck are you going to do? And I said, well, I'm going to play an F. Which I've never played Whiskey in the Jar in my life in F. Gee. It's always been in G. I mean, I could play it upside down in a paper bag in G.
Yeah, well, it's always been in G. That's the way. When I learned how to play guitar, and I did learn how to play your version of Whiskey in the Jar, I played it in G on a Strat,
That's right. Like
you.
That's right. Sure. But that night I went on with them, I had to play it in F.
That's weird.
Absolutely, it was one of the so strange. As I walked on the stage. Like, it was my turn to do Whiskey in the Jar with him. And said, okay, would you please welcome to the stage Mr. Eric Bell? And I'm going, it's an F. It's an F.
Oh,
it's
God.
An F. Because my finger would automatically go into the key of G. I've been doing it so long in G.
Wow.
And I had to keep saying, it's an F. Man. And the bastards didn't pay me.
Oh, they never paid you for that?
No.
Jeez.
Not a fucking penny.
Well, I guess let's move on from Metallica.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry. On August 20th, 2005, what would have been Phil's 56th birthday, a statue of Phil was unveiled in Dublin. A show was put together which featured Gary Moore on lead vocals and guitar, along with other Thin Lizzy all-stars, including you. Was this an exciting experience working alongside all of these former members of Thin Lizzy? Well, you never, you pretty much said you didn't think it was Thin Lizzy.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, like, don't get me wrong, like, I do like meeting Brian Robinson. You know, he's a bit of a lad, but I get on with him very well.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Gary. I've known Gary for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
And I love seeing Brian Downey. Brian Downey was one of my best friends. And Scott, you know, I get on well with Scott. So I get on with all of them. And it was a very moving concert, that. It really was. That's the one that was out in DVD, you mean?
Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. I mean,
yeah,
it was a tribute.
Yeah. It was an excellent night. It really was. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I just wish I had played another song, you know, but...
Well, Whiskey in the Jar has always been your...
Sure.
Your song. It's your signature, sure. Almost. I mean, you know.
You see, I thought...
I always thought The Rocker was kind of your song, too, with that long solo.
Right, I mean, Gary Moore would have been bored shitless for me doing a five-minute guitar solo, you know?
I always loved The Rocker, and I love the longer version with your solo. You're like one of the most underrated guitar players on the planet. I've like said it alongside anybody. I just one of the best, and one of the, man, you should get more attention. That's
well,
all I can say. I mean, definitely.
I'm working on it.
I hope so. Well, I'll work on it from my end, right here.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, in 2008, you received a Lifetime Achievement Award at the International Guitar Festival in Ireland. Do you consider this to be one of your proudest moments?
It was. Put it this way, it was a very big surprise because I played the show that night, and this sort of compere came on and said, "Right, Eric, this is your last song, but." When you walk off the stage, don't go into the changing room, stand in the wings. And I sort of looked at him and said, okay. So we did our last song. I said, thank you very much. Good night. Hope you enjoyed it. And walked off. And then this guy came out on the stage and he started talking about, Irish guitar players. And he said, Rory Gallagher, you know, blah, blah, blah. He started talking about Rory a lot. And then he started talking about Gary Moore. And I was in the wings, and I said, what the fuck about me? As a joke. As a fucking joke. I just said it. There was a few people standing beside me, and I said, when's he going to fucking mention me? As a joke. And all of a sudden he says, I'm not forgetting Mr. Eric Bell. And I went, what? What? And the next minute... He's waving me on the stage. And I went, fucking hell. And I walked out, and he started talking about me, and I was like fucking blown away completely, you know. I was just couldn't believe it. And he said, I'd like to present you with this award. And it was really such a nice moment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Really nice moment.
Definitely great.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
It was such a surprise. That's what it was.
Well, that's great. It's
such a surprise.
Surprises like that. People should...
Yeah. Sure. Give me more.
Are you satisfied with your albums being reissued to the world, such as 1995's Live Tonight?
Yes. That one is some... I mean, I play it still sometimes, and there's some good playing on it. And I've had some very good reviews about it. There's a lot of people like that album.
I love that album, honest to God.
Yeah?
I've played that a lot.
Oh, good.
Yeah, no, I really do. I like the way you everything on it, all those blues tunes, the whole thing. It's just a great album. All in all, the way it was recorded was great.
Yeah, it just captured it. It really did.
Yeah.
And that was a borrowed Marshall. You know, in the afternoon in that club, someone had brought me down an amplifier, which I tried, and it was a heap of shit. You know, it was no good.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, man, I can't use this. Are you joking? And I think one of the guys that worked in the club, one of the barmen, said, I've got a Marshall, Eric, if you want to try it out. And I said, yes, please. And he brought it down, and that's what I plugged into.
Wow.
Yeah. I wanted to bring it back in the plane.
So it was perfect.
Oh, it was a great amp. It was like straight in, no effects, and, you know.
That's perfect.
Fabulous.
You don't need effects.
Well, I use a blues thing now, a blues driver.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a little pedal. It gives you a little bit of sustain, a little bit of dirt.
Yeah.
And I just said, yeah, so that's what I use at the moment.
Okay, what was it like finding new territories to tour, such as the Ukraines? And how was the crowd's response to the music?
It was good. Because I didn't know what to expect. But a better one than that, Mark, was my drummer is Polish, you know, sort of part Polish,
mm-hmm.
and he knows lots of musicians in Poland. And he said to me one day, "Why don't I organize a tour for us in Poland?"
Wow!
I hadn't played Poland since early Thin Lizzy.
Oh, early Thin Lizzy played Poland? That I didn't know.
Yeah, as far as I know. Yeah, because, you know, as I said earlier, we played Germany and Holland and Sweden. And
mm-hmm.
I'm sure we touched Poland at some point. But anyway, he got us about 9 gigs in Poland. And
wow.
It was incredible. I couldn't believe it.
That's great.
Every single place had a really big crowd of people. I thought it was going to be deserted. Just a huge crowd in every place we played. And they just listened.
Mm-hmm.
They really, really sit there or stand there and they listen to every note you play.
How amazing.
And they really show their appreciation.
That's great.
It was marvelous. I couldn't believe it. Absolutely marvelous it was.
That's great. I think I'm done with my questions.